You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
ACT Party MP Todd Stevenson has recently relodged his end-of-life choice amendment bill and incorporated all 25 recommendations from the Ministry of Health's independent review. Many doctors believe that in order to effectively carry out assisted dying practices, they need to be properly supported. Psychological medicine researcher Dr. Ida Dakota recalls that while most of these doctors and nurses affirm their patients' autonomy and right to choose, challenges still persist. I spoke to Dr. Dakota about how these practitioners can be better supported and some of the challenges faced on the front lines. What challenges do doctors and nurses face when administering assisted dying?
The assisted dying practitioners face a couple of barriers that is related to eligibility criteria and some of the safeguards. The first one, and I think the most important one, is the terminal diagnosis and the 6 months life expectancy criteria. So a lot of the practitioners find it difficult to make a very accurate prognosis because a lot of the terminal diagnosis, you know, terminal illnesses like neurodegenerative illnesses, they do not simply fit within that 6 months time frame. So make it very difficult to make that prognosis. So they miss out on this on the assisted dying provision. And the second one, I think, is the assisting unbearable suffering. The problem is that there is no measurement for how to define or measure unbearable suffering, which make it subjective. But this subjectivity could be a benefit because it would mean that it's completely up to the patients to describe how they're suffering, how much they're suffering, and whether their quality of life has decreased. But it can and also kind of lead to confusion because a lot of the patients have difficulty admitting that they are suffering unbearably because they are trying so much to manage the symptoms and stay well and enjoy life. So that becomes a little bit problematic. The other one is related to some of the safeguard. For example, the conscientious objection safeguard. Any health professionals or practitioners are allowed to be conscientiously object, but if they're approached, they have to refer the patients, you know, to the team, to the assisted dying service. But this has caused problem because a lot of the practitioners have to approach the patient's primary care team to gather some information about, you know, prognosis and diagnosis. But they found that a lot, some of the health professionals, they've been withholding these information that's required for the assessment because they don't, you know, they're personally and professionally object with the assisted dying principle. And they've had some patients who describe experiences where, you know, they've been refused referral to the service, and that can delay the assessment process or can create access issues. But then the next level, I mean, conscientious objection can also happen on systemic level, which means like a lot of the regulatory bodies, I would say, for example, hospices, aged residential care facilities and rest homes, they are reluctant to allow assisted dying assessment or provision on their premises. So, for example, like hospitals, they are to be used as a last resort if there is no other place in New Zealand that accommodate this service. This means that there is a limit, you know, that limits delivery sites and can complicate or even make the service impossible or inaccessible. And I mean, if you look at this, I mean, as a deeper level, is that if practitioners sometimes they have to go into these organizations in disguise, you know, not announcing who they are, or they have to do the assessments like on the bus stop, you know, in the car outside that premises, in which can, you know, send a message to them and their person, you know, that they're doing something wrong or unethical, you know, which can create, you know, increase the stigma around it. And what else? Okay, the stigma. That's another barrier. I mean, the challenge, because a lot of the practitioners, they kind of fear the backlash from the community, the colleagues, the families, or they afraid of being misunderstood or judged. So they have to kind of, which it's kind of these challenges kind of push them towards, you know, secrecy. So we're going to keep this a secret from anyone, which can cause, you know, different layers of problems.
How do practitioners ensure patients are fully informed and are in the right mental state to make a judgment?
So they do competency assessments. So for example, what that happens is that they meet the patients, they have their medical record, and then when they meet the patients, they for example, go through a process of if whether the patient understands, you know, what assisted dying is, what the result of that would be, and whether they are aware of the, you know, the pros and cons of the chosen end-of-life options or the treatment they chose to have. And so they also assess whether they can retain this information, they can, relate to their, any information about their, you know, their end-of-life choice, the treatment options, assisted dying, and they can recall the discussion with their attending medical practitioners or the independent medical practitioners who do the assessment. So there's a kind of conversation on personal level, you know, and very in-depth conversation with patients to make sure they understand this option and what it means for them.
And how do you manage disagreements between patients and their families about assisted dying?
Okay, so the disagreement, I think it's more like it is for the patients to resolve that with with their family members. But they normally have conversation, they listen to the patients and the concerns, family members, and they can answer to, you know, because a lot of the concerns family have is around the misinformation about assisted dying, or they simply don't know how the process works, what it's involved in that. So when they respond to these concerns these questions, that can resolve, you know, disagreement between family members. But the other thing they will look for is the possibility of coercion. So to assess that, they would have conversation with the whole family, patients and family, and they would have separate conversation without the presence of family member with the patient to make sure they are not, pressured into this in any form of way. And so that's how they go about that. And if they have any concerns, they would raise it, and then the process would stop there, and they would raise it with this service, the registrar, and resolve that. Yeah.
And there's been a lot of debates about whether assisted dying is a right or a privilege. What would you say about this?
I've interviewed a lot of practitioners, patients, and family members, and most of them, they do consider it as a privilege. So because it helps to alleviate suffering, and it helps, you know, they kind of, the practitioners, a lot of them told me that it's honor to be able to help, you know, patients to kind of practice their rights, you know, and autonomy and alleviate suffering and creating to just help them, you know, to meet their end-of-life wishes. And also family members, they see it as a gift, because it limits the suffering. And it's kind of leads to a more good, as we call it, good death or peaceful death. It's a better alternative because the family members, you know, the patients, they're already dying, and most of them, their disease and their death is not a good or easy death. So when they consider it as a better alternative,
What extra training and support do healthcare providers need in relation to assisted dying?
So they are being trained. They are, e-learning modules produced in a, provided by the Ministry of Health. Practitioners who wants to be involved in the service provision, and they do they complete these modules. It's not compulsory, but most of them they do if they want to be reimbursed for their service. And but they all kind of express at the beginning they need more specialist training. For example, how do we do competency assessment, or how do we do IV intravenous training? So, but what we've been seeing that since then, I mean, the ministry and now Te Whatu'ua listen to them and they are providing this trainings. But what they mostly need is more practitioners providing the service, so more workforce, because especially in rural areas there are not enough practitioners who provide this, and which can, you know, delay and put more pressure on practitioners, because they're already doing it after their working hours on the weekends. So that's very demanding, and especially if you are attending medical practitioner, that you are doing the first assessment and you're with the families, you know, the patients throughout the whole process, and you are the one who delivered the service. This is a very time consuming and demanding job, and most of them could help with having a colleague with them, especially when they're delivering the service on the day, which is funded to have support service, you know, support colleague there. But the problem is there's not enough practitioners who know the process and who are, you know, able to help.
That was the University of Auckland's Dr. Ida Dakota on the experiences of assisted dying practitioners. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.